streaming on Paramount Plus.
You ready, Bob?
Well, all right.
Audiences are raving. Bob Marley is electrifying. It's the feel-good movie of the year.
You dig?
Bob Marley, One Love. Rated PG-13. Now streaming on Paramount Plus.
This is NASCAR driver Tony Breininger inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers, one love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Size your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone. And welcome to New Books in East Asia. In this podcast, I speak with Pilis Chan about her latest book, The Making of a Modern Outworld, Institutionalization and Legitimization of Gohua in Republican Shanghai, published by Brill in 2017. The Making of a Modern Outworld investigates the production and consumption of Gohua, or national painting, in Shanghai between 1929 and the outbreak of the Second Sino-Japanese War in 1937. Defining the art world as sociologically constructed, Pilis Chan's systematically researched book focuses on collective practices of artists and art associations, periodicals, art colleges, exhibitions, and the art market, all of which contributed to the institutionalization and legitimization of Gohua in Republican Shanghai. Based on extensive primary source material, Chan lays bare the modus operandi of a modern art world in Republican Shanghai during that period. The book is thus an indispensable resource for anybody working in the field of 20th century Chinese painting, highlighting the changing hierarchies, networks, and discursive practices that constituted Republican Shanghai, Guohua. Welcome to the show, Pilis.
Thank you.
Why don't you start out by telling us a little bit about yourself?
I'm Pilis Chan, and currently I'm an assistant professor of cultural management of the Chinese University of Hong Kong. Before I joined the Chinese University of Hong Kong, I worked as an assistant professor for cultural and heritage management at the City University of Hong Kong. And in the late 1990s, I also got a four-year curatorial experience with the Hong Kong Museum of Art. And my research interest centered on the production and consumption of art in modern and contemporary China.
So tell us how you came to write The Making of a Modern Art World in Republican Shanghai.
Yeah, the book actually is developed from my PhD dissertation. And my interest in the Republican period actually is based on my archival research in Shanghai. When I was conducting archival research in Shanghai, I encountered a lot of primary materials, including magazine, newspapers, and exhibition catalogs. These materials tell a very different stories about the narrative of modern Chinese art. And firstly, we can see that from this material, there's a lot of people involved in the production and consumption of art in Republican period. And a lot of this name are not actually mentioned in the standard art history book. And secondly, we can see that from this material is that dominance of Guohua in the field. And as we know from the standard narrative of Chinese art history, it always mentioned that Guohua was under attack. And however, the material tells that Guohua actually dominates in the art world, particularly like in the metropolitan city Shanghai. And lastly, the material also tells that a group of people, they call themselves a art community, or they are from the art world, actually exist in Shanghai. So I'm quite interested is to reconstruct the operational logic and also the practice, the discursive practice in this period, how the artists thought and how they determined their artistic style and how their artistic practice are constrained by social structure and also by different kind of factors. And I hope that which can give a very different perspective for us to understand the Republican art world.
Mm. And the book has a considerably small time span, covering the 8 years between 1929 to 1937. Why don't you tell us a little bit more about why you chose these dates in particular and why they're so crucial for what it is you're doing in this book.
Mm-hmm. I chose the 19th decade, approximately actually is the 19th decade from the 1927 to 1937, because this period is the golden period in Republican period. Politically is relatively stable after the consolidation of power from the nationalist government. And I set 1929 because I think sometimes the periodization of art history is a little bit different from the political history. For instance, a lot of modern Chinese art, they set the Opium War as the beginning of modern Chinese art. But we can tell that the war actually won't change the practice and won't change the taste. I set 1929 because in this year, the nationalist government support the first national art exhibition, which was launched in Shanghai. And according to the primary material, and we also can see that the committee member from the preparation of this exhibition, actually a lot of these members come from the Shanghai art world. And I think this is a quite significant event because it marked the and also show the official discourse on modern art. And from this exhibition, we can see that the number of Guohua outnumber other category like oil painting or sculpture. So it also review the aesthetic ideology embraced by the nationalist government. So I think 1929 and after the late since the late 1920s onward, a lot of Guohua artistic activity became prominent in the Shanghai art world. So I set the 1929 as the beginning. And 1937, obviously, is because of the war, the Sino-Japanese war. And the war actually generated a great impact on the Shanghai art world. A lot of artistic activity stopped by the war. So as the book focuses on artistic activity and the collective power of the art community from Guohua, so I think this short time of period is the golden period for the development of Guohua.
Okay, and the book is divided into three main chapters, plus introduction and conclusion. So why don't we start out by setting the scene, so to speak, for our listeners, by talking about the three main groups of actors or agents who shape the art world and the hierarchies within it. So you named the literati or the ilal, the new merchants, and the new intelligentsia / entrepreneurial class, if you will. Tell us more about how you define and divide these three groups and how they in turn shaped the art world.
As I mentioned in previous questions, I find that there's a collective power in the Shanghai art world. So I'm trying to find a framework to look at and analyze to address the question I wanted to answer. And I find that sociology approach are quite important in this way. I particularly inspired by Howard Becker's concept of art world, because he mentioned that art from the production to the circulation and consumption actually involves a lot of agent and actor in the process. And Bourdieu's idea is more sophisticated. He talk about how in the artistic field and different actors and members are they actually in a conflictual position. They are competing for resources and they are competing for different position. And a artistic field is like other field, like the political field, is very hierarchical. Some member, they possess more capitals, they are on top of the hierarchy, while the new member, they need some support from the older generation. So I analyze the material, the primary material, I find that there are some famous member. Their name had been mentioned many times frequently in the press media. So I tried to divide them into different groups. This actor, they are actually on top of the hierarchy because even they attend an exhibition ceremony and opening, these kind of attendance will be mentioned in newspaper. You can imagine they are very famous and also familiar to the reader, newspaper readers. And these, I divided them into three groups because since the downfall of the Qing dynasty, we know China transformed into a new society. A new social structure was constructed. And the first group is the literati yilao. They are those who lost their position after the downfall of the Qing dynasty. And they attracted to Shanghai because it's a heaven for the yilao. They accumulate a lot of cultural capital as well as economic capital. And their name has been mentioned many times in press media. And for instance, Zhang Daqian was well known for his relationship with Zheng Xi. Zheng Xi is also a yilao. And this yilao, they are quite proud of their title. So they mentioned that they are the yilao. And of course, they got the power like to consecrate the newcomers, like to issue the prize list for the new members and the younger generation. And another group is the new merchants. As we know, in the late Qing dynasty and early Republican period, commerce became a way to build a strong nation, and wealth also became a very important capital to elevate one's status in the society. And these new merchants, they for instance, serve as the middleman between Chinese and overseas trade. And like Wang Yiting, and he's a new merchant and he got multiple identity, merchant artist, and he also a very prestigious member in the Shanghai art world. And these merchants, they apply some kind of commercial tactic in the art world, for instance, organize exhibition for sale. And also they got some power to consecrate the young generation. And the last one is the new intellectuals, and they are the senior member in the art world. They got a degree from the previous civil examination, but you know, the downfall of the Qin dynasty, and they transformed themselves into a new elite class. For instance, Ye Gongshuo, he got a degree from civil examination, and he also served as a high official in the Republican period for the nationalist government. And I think the first chapter, the introduction, is trying to give a clear framework about how I will discuss the questions and how to set the ground for the following discussions.
Great. That kind of also answers a follow-up question that I was wondering about, which is why Baudieu's sociological ideas about cultural capital and artistic fields and so on were so useful when looking at the institutionalization and legitimization of Guohua. So I think we'll move on. And I was... You know, this is now the inevitable question that mm-hmm. I suppose everybody was waiting for. We couldn't possibly do this interview, and you couldn't have possibly written the book without addressing the tricky question of what Guohua actually is. So basically, let's talk about the definition, if you will. And I was wondering if you could say a few words on that.
Guohua actually is quite a problematic term. And according to the material we can see, Guohua is a new invention in the early 20th or the late 19th centuries. It's a term borrowed from Japan. Actually refer to national painting. Before the introduction of Xihua, I don't think we need something to distinguish this category of art from other category, because Shuhua always dominant the art scene. But the introduction of different category like sculpture, watercolor, oil painting to the Chinese art world, and a new term was needed to refer to the traditional practice. The category usually executed with brush and ink and the traditional equipment, and also on paper or seal. And so that's why I think when you have a new term, that means there's some new concept. So what is Guohua actually is the book concern. I want to know how they use different practice and different institution to construct the idea and give a concrete idea about what is Guohua. And Guohua actually later on developed into different terms like Zhongguohua. In the after the 1949, they used Zhongguohua instead of Guohua, and Shuimohua, Caimohua. And now we have a new term, is the contemporary Eng, Eng art. And so all these terms are very tricky and also problematic, but it's is interesting is that the layered meaning attached to this term.
To institutionalization as practice, you reveal in incredible detail how Guohua institutionalized by way of looking at three different practices: organizing art societies, publishing art periodicals, and establishing art colleges. Unfortunately, we won't have the time to discuss all three phenomena in great detail, but I would like you to talk a little bit about all of them, especially because you've amassed such an incredible amount of data, as seen in the five appendices in your book. So the first one is on art societies established during the years 1929 to 36. What struck you as significant or noteworthy, if you will, when you collected and evaluated all this data on art societies that were founded during these years?
Mm-hmm. I set this as the first chapter because, as I mentioned, my interest is the production and consumption of art. So I set three different chapters. And this chapter two is on the productions and how collective power was formed during this period. And I find that art society is a very powerful institution. It gathers different artists, different talents, and also different experts from all over the nation who settle in Shanghai. And also, art society is a very active actor in the art world. They organize exhibitions to showcase the artwork. So that is the circulation of artwork. And also, they publish societal magazines. This is became a platform for artists to convey or to communicate with the public about the aesthetic they embrace. And this member are also the member, a lot of this member from the art society are also the member who talk at the art college. And art college is an important institution for nurturing the new generation of artists in modern China. And so this chapter focuses on is the production of art. And the next chapter is on circulation. Exhibition became a very important channel for artists to showcase their artwork. And the chapter four is on consumption. So it's from production, circulation to consumption. And the data that I collected show that during this period, roughly 1929 to 1936, the number of art society increased dramatically. And of course, a lot of this society are short-lived. And it suggests that there's a very severe competition in the art world. So it's like what Bourdieu say, they are always in a conflictual situation and relation, and they compete for resources and they compete for position. And so this is one of the perspective I want to add to our understanding of modern Chinese art. It shows that the transformation of art or artistic practice is not only affected by introduction of Western art or the revival or the preservation of Chinese culture, but also conditioned by the competition between different actors in the same art world. For competition, each art society, they will define their position. They will not take the same stand as the others. So in this chapter, I focus on two important art society, the Bean Society and the Chinese Painting Society. And we can see that they position themselves different from those society established in the early 20th century, which focus on preservation of Chinese accents. Society also reject to in alignment with the reformers who promote westernization of Chinese art. So they choose a different position and they position themselves as new Chinese artists. And they promoted their aesthetic as they preserve Chinese art, but at the same time, they look at different culture. And also, they will use a new attitude toward the practice of Guohua. In the past, artists always always regarded the practicing of Guohua or painting as a kind of entertainment or leisure. But in from these two association, we can see that they position themselves as professional painter. They took Guohua or the practice of Guohua seriously and like a new academic discipline. So I think this chapter discusses about the art organization, art society, and how the society publish periodicals, and also the member from this society talk at the art college. And this is a kind of institutionalization, mm-hmm. how to, what is Guohua? And it is through this practice they offer and they institutionalize the ideas of Guohua.
And how closely these three were related becomes really very clear, I thought, with this one example of the Bee Society, which I found particularly enlightening, and then entertaining journal, Mi Feng, or the Bee Journal. And so, yeah, maybe you could say a few words on this as just as an example.
Mm-hmm. The Bee Journal is a very interesting, entertaining journal. And when I first encountered the journal, I find it interesting because the format is actually quite similar to those pictorial newspaper. That kind of newspaper is for entertainment. But it's a very important outlet. Some important essay published in the Bee Journal. From the Bee Journal's cover, we can see that it marketed the journal as an entertainment journal. Some famous ladies' portrait used to decorate the cover, and some senior prestigious member from the art world also used to decorate the cover. So I think for the reader, when they look at the format and look at the cover design, they know this is a kind of entertainment journal. But in fact, in the journal, there's some important essay about Guohua was published. However, from the editorial content, we can see the journal actually have no a very concrete or substantial editorial ideas. But later on, a lot of this committee, the editor from the Bee Journal, they launched another new journal. It's Guohua Monthly. And from the book, from the cover design and the content, it showed that they have a very clear directions about the journal. And they tried to create an image for the journal and as well as the art society, because this journal are actually the societal journal. And Guohua Monthly and then Guohua are published by the Chinese Painting Society. And the editor have a very clear directions about the journal. Unlike Bee Journal, Guohua Monthly and then Guohua, they publish essays and also some news of the member from the art scene. And for instance, they even invite some oil painter to collaborate to for a special issue on the idea of landscape painting. And I think that this is a quite it shows a very different understanding or a different stories of the Shanghai art world. Actually, Guohua, they can collaborate with oil painter, and they the journal became a platform for all these discussions between members from different societies.
And just a few words on the art colleges too, in particular?
Yeah, art college. At the beginning, most of the art college focus on Western art training, oil painting, for instance, because it's easy to market. Once you got this technique, you can work in the commercial sector. But later on, from the 1920s onward, we can see Guohua previously was taught by taught by private tuitions. And in the Republican period, this kind of teaching also included in the educational curriculum, the new art curriculum in New China. And curriculum is something which can reflect what Guohua means and how the knowledge of Guohua could be taught systematically through different courses. And from these colleges, we can see how they also use college as an institution to institutionalize Guohua practice through teaching. So the new generation, they will know what is Guohua. For instance, during that time, they need to learn literature. They need to learn philosophy. And also, of course, sanshui and birds and flowers and figure painting. But you can see it's not only about technique, it's also about some Chinese knowledge, some knowledge about art, philosophy, and aesthetics. So this part actually is focused on how Guohua curriculum have been developed during this period.
I want to follow up on this just very briefly, because what you just described, this more holistic approach to teaching, that's in line with how literatis of previous times understood themselves. Is that correct? Or is there a break in some way in the curriculum and the teaching of the art colleges in comparison to earlier literati?
Earlier literati, obviously, they are quite interdisciplinary. And in the early 20th century, the new educational system actually divide different knowledge in different discipline. And in a way, you can't train a literati anymore. This tradition continue actually also realize in the new curriculum is that art is not just about skill, but also about your thought, your understanding of the tradition, for instance, art history, and how you understand the philosophy of Chinese tradition, and how this can be embedded in your practice. And in some way, actually, is the literati's view on art. But I don't think that student trained in this curriculum, it could be a literati themselves, because you know, there's an other discipline is called Chinese literature at that time. So even though they got some training in literature or poetry, but they are not as good as their predecessor.
In the next chapter, you go on to talk about a sea change in cultural practice, bringing paintings from a private art world to the public sphere, thereby not just changing methods of display, enabling a new viewing experience, shaping public taste, etc., but also encouraging the commercialization of art on a whole different scale in comparison to earlier periods. And again, you substitute your research with an appendix of exhibitions held during the year 1919 and 1937. Could you tell our listeners a bit more about the commercial world, the social networks, as well as the government and so on and so forth, who all encouraged a veritable exhibition culture, and maybe also what each was hoping to gain from it?
Mm-hmm. I think different exhibition culture is a new thing and also a new concept introduced to China in the late 19th century when the Chinese government, the Qing government, participate in a lot of international expositions and welfare. And in this kind of international art fair, international exposition, the function or the purpose of this exhibition is to showcase the products from China or from China and to construct the a national identity, and also is for trading. So the commercial element has already embedded in exhibition. And the early exhibition organized on art objects in China, some of these exhibitions are launched by the merchants in Shanghai, and like Wang Yiting, Li Pingshu, I've mentioned the name at the beginning in first chapter because they are the quite important actor in the art scene. They apply commercial tactics in into the art world. And so to exhibit artwork is a new idea because, you know, in the past, the viewing opportunity is confined in private space, not much in a public space. So you can imagine that if artists are going to showcase their work to a public, they will going to have a quite different audience, expected audience. And all these kind of factors actually will determine how artists to choose their style and how they build their personal style. And exhibition was also a new kind of capital. If you know the knowledge how to make use exhibition, which can help the artist to gain reputation, to promote the artist, and also to promote not just individual artists, but also art society, art groups, and also nation. So in this chapter, I discuss about different parties, how they make use of exhibition as a means to for different purpose. For instance, the government, they apply exhibition to construct national identity. In the 1930s, two important individuals, Liu Haishu and Xu Beihong, with the support from the government, they organized contemporary Chinese painting exhibition in Europe. And so if you're going to bring the Chinese artworks to international audience, you will think about what kind of art will represent China. So inevitably, they choose Guohua as the only art form to include it in the exhibition. And this is also a requirement from the European counterpart collaborator. They didn't want to see something which like the Western style painting from China, but they want to see the authentic Chinese artworks. Therefore, the confirmation of the value of Guohua in a way also assert its status in China. And for art society, exhibition is also a way to promote the aesthetic embraced by the art society. So there's the number of exhibition increase dramatically, also hand in hand with the increasement in different Guohua society. And I focus on art society, the Bean Society, for instance, and how the Bean Society organized societal exhibitions. And we can see that from the empirical data provided in the appendix, you can see the format of exhibition was standardized. For instance, it always lasts for 3 days to 1 week. So it's very short. And exhibit will be renewed every day or every 2 days. So you can see they change the exhibit list continually during the show. And this practice obviously influenced by the commercial aspect of exhibition, because audience or the visitor, they view the exhibition and they bought some of the exhibit, and so you have to make replacement. And the empirical data also show that an exhibition, for instance, some kind of specific exhibition are very popular during different season. For instance, in summer, fan exhibition are very popular because fan painting is a kind of functional and also is a indicator of social status. You can imagine that it's like what branch of handbag you are using at that time is whose painting are on the fan you are using. For our society, this is the way to gain some reputation. For instance, if they can include most of the famous artists in their group exhibition, this obviously will elevate its social status, and also in the competitive art world, and they can stand out from other different social artistic groups. For individuals, for individual artists, the rise of exhibition culture also generate great impact on artistic practice. You can imagine that if you need to organize a solo exhibition, for instance, twice a year, and you have to produce over 200 piece of exhibit. So artists will be very productive and constrained by the exhibition culture, and they need to show new artwork to the audience. For the audience and the visitor, they are expected something new for exhibition. And in this chapter, I use Zhang Daqian and Yu Jianhua as case studies to show how they use exhibition to construct their own personal persona. Zhang Daqian, you can see, it's very funny, and he presented himself as a traditional literati, and he didn't care about material gain, but in reality, he cared about fame and also about commercial economic gains in exhibition, through exhibition. And Yu Jianhua, he also used different tactics to present his artwork to the publics. For instance, he invite some celebrities and prestigious cultural leaders to attend his exhibitions and to pen reviews on his artwork. As I mentioned in the introductions, these celebrities and cultural leaders, they possess symbolic capital. So their presence in the exhibition or their support for the artist's exhibition is a kind of process of consecration or recognition of the artist. In a way, they can elevate the artist's status, particularly the young artist's status in the art world. And for individual artists, exhibition is a way to gain fame and also money. And a society, for artistic society, it is also a way to gain fame and also to promote their aesthetics ideology, as well as to gain some commercial gain. And for the nation, exhibition is a way to construct the person national identity to showcase the artistic accomplishment to the international audience.
Great. I want to follow up on this because, you know, being based in Berlin and at the Asian Art Museum, this is incredibly interesting because usually, you know, in England and as well as Germany and other parts of Europe, it's Liu Haisu who was the kind of representative of the Chinese government coming to Europe. But for France, it's Su Beihong in particular, you see. And so there's almost a divide between those two as well. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering if you could say a few more words on Su Beihong. And
from the primary material, it show that they are the rival. But the same purpose, they rival with same purpose is to represent as a mediator between Chinese government and European institutions to organize and serving like a curator to organize, to get a different kind of artwork and to showcase what is a contemporary Chinese art in the early 20th century. Xu Beihong, I think his connection with France is very obvious because he received training in France. And Liu Haisu, and his very smart young artist, he established the art college and he's very active and also support by the government to visit different art academy in Europe and also in Japan. And for Liu Haisu's show, for instance, the process of the preparation is that they Liu Haisu, he determined what kind of art should include in the exhibition. And this was quite controversial. And also the Shanghai art world, like the Chinese Painting Association led by Wang Yitin, they published an open letter to Liu Haisu complaining that the process of organizing this exhibition is not transparent enough. So in response to their request, Liu Haisu eventually opened the call. But, you know, still even opened the call and still he had the power to determine what kind of art should be included. I think all exhibition cannot be say is neutral because different party and actor involved in the exhibition, they got the right and all those, also the authorities to determine what kind of art should be included in this exhibition. Obviously, Xu Beihong and Liu Haisu, they pick up some painting from their social network. include the painting from their friends, the fellow artists, and their fellow artists will also include their students' work in the exhibition. So this is how they organize the exhibition. But it's also quite important is that this exhibition gained quite a good response in Europe. And it also shaped how the Europeans' view of contemporary Chinese art, or Guohua, in this period. And most importantly, and also this exhibition also contributed to the formation of modern Chinese painting collection in Europe.
Yes, great. Thank you. So to kind of sum up, wrap this up, art periodicals, art societies and schools, as well as exhibitions, all combined resulted in a really matured art world that encouraged the production, distribution and consumption of guohua, as we started out this interview too. And so in chapter 4, you're going to talk about money, really, and reveal how price lists were written, produced, and distributed. And so I wanted you to share this fascinating insight into the price lists, and then also how the pricing of artworks mm-hmm. worked.
This chapter is quite interesting, and even a reader have no any background knowledge of modern Chinese art, I think is this the material presented in this chapter will interest the readers. And in this chapter, I focus on the consumption of guohua and how different kind of capital, like symbolic capital, cultural capital, social capital, could be converted into economic capital. And also symbolic capital too. And the market is fascinating during this the Republican period, because it is during this period price list will publish publicly in press media, like newspaper and magazine. So it's easier for us to collect the data. And these price lists are written in great detail, and it also showed that the artists are not ashamed to exchange their artwork for money, and which was a taboo in the previous in Imperial China. Even though in Imperial China, actually artists also exchange their artwork for different kind of material gain. And so in this period, I think the artists published their price list because they regarded practicing art is a kind of professional practice, like a lawyer. And lawyer, you can also have a price. And so the price list is a quite indigenous practice in China. And the price was determined by the market, because in that time, we can't see any intervention from the government. Unlike in Japan, some price may be actually influenced by the state. And in China, if the price was determined by the markets, and we can see at the taste what kind of art will interest the audience, they will really spend money to buy. And from the price list, it also reflects something quite different from the standard narrative of Chinese art. For instance, Ni Zhan, a very highly regarded artist, and his style had been practiced by the Orthodox school in the late Qing period. But his price could be, if an artist paint in the style of Ni Zhan in Republican period, you can get some kind of discounts, because Ni Zhan's work style is very economic. He used very few brushwork for his painting. So you can see the consideration in the market. And the data, the information from the price list also provides a lot of information, like what kind of style was priced highly and what kind of style are preferred by the are popular in the market. For instance, like blue and green landscape, which was not quite promoted by the literati taste, but you know, you need to use more color and skill for blue and green style, so you need to pay more if you want to have one of this painting. And it's also interesting that in the market, the four wands, in the debate of what is more in the debates about the value of modern Chinese painting.
Hello. Sorry. Wir machen ein Interview. Ich hoffe, das stört Sie nicht, wenn wir ganz kurz.
For instance, the Four Wangs style, which have been criticized severely by the reformers. In the market, we can see some artists, they present themselves as a loyal follower of Four Wangs, like Feng Chaoran, Wu Hufan. Their prize on top of the list, and they are their painting are the most expensive in the Shanghai art world, and they all claim themselves as the loyal follower of the Four Wang Orthodox. So this is provide a very different perspective for us to think about the value or the taste of Guohua in Republican period. And another interesting point is that once you have an open market, and then there will be more different kind of position, which some of the people or individual they serve as the mediator in the market, and this is also a way to provide some job opportunity in the Shanghai art world, and consumption is also a way to preserve some artwork and also to provide economic support for the art world to sustain. So I think it's a quite important part in the autonomous and healthy, mature art world. And unfortunately, because of the war, we can see the number of price lists published decreased dramatically. And I can see that actually after the war, some artists continue to sold their painting in the open market in Shanghai. But eventually, it is after 1949, the establishment of the Republican PRC, that selling artwork in the market is no longer exist, and the market moved to other cities like Hong Kong.
And in fact, you end your book with the year 1937 as well, the breakout of the Sino-Japanese War. Thank you so much for this really excellent interview and this amazing book. Now, tell us what you're working on now after finishing this book, and what your research includes.
I'm not working on a project on landscape painting. Landscape has always been my research interest because landscape it seems to be quite neutral, but in fact, it's quite political. Now I'm working on a project on the correlationship between landscape painting, landscape aesthetic, nationalism, and modern tourism. I use different famous scenic sites, particularly those in the southeast China, for instance, like Huangshan and Yandang, and use this site as a entry points. This site, the place that a lot of different human activity took place. And in the Republican period, is from it seems that a lot of artists visit Yandang, for instance, and they also paint landscape painting based on the scenic site. So I want to know why these artists start visiting new site, and how this site have been singled out by the government for modern tourism, and how the Chinese landscape aesthetic can be employed by the government to construct a national perspective to or national ways to to view beautiful scenes and famous mountain. So it's about the how nationalist government also use art as a way for political propaganda to create and construct some political ideology.
Great, very much looking forward to your next book. And for now, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me.
Thank you very much.